Amen. Tell you what, WCN has gifted and dedicated musicians, and I'm so grateful for that. There are other people who are gifted, and it's one thing to be gifted, but it's another thing to be gifted and dedicated to the work of the Lord. Well, this morning we're going to be in Matthew 25, and I invite you to go ahead and turn there if you'd like to do that. Matthew chapter 24 and 25 contain some of Jesus' last teachings. This is right before his arrest and everything that follows his arrest. The important thing for you to know when we get to Matthew 24 and Matthew 25 is that Jesus is about to go away. And he tells us four parables in a row. Today we're going to look at one of those four parables, but all four of the parables that he tells in a row have commonalities. In all four of these parables, there is a master or an owner who goes away and then returns. And then when the master or owner returns, the people are judged according to what they did do or what they did not do. So it's no accident that Jesus is telling these parables right before he goes away. Matthew 25, starting with verse 14. Again, Jesus says, it, meaning the kingdom of heaven, will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave five, now some of your Bibles say talents or bags of gold or measurements of wealth. To another he gave two bags, and to another one bag, each according to his own ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received five went at once and put his money to work and gained five more. So also the one with two gained two more. But the man who had received one went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received five brought the other five. Master, he said, you entrusted me with five. See, I gained five more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with two also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with two. See, I've gained two more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received one came. Master, he said, I knew that you're a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I do not scatter seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the bag from him and give it to the one who has 10. For those who have will be given more and will have an abundance. As for those who do not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. A talent was a measurement of money in Jesus' day. One talent was the equivalent of about 15 years of wages for the average laborer. So if you multiply your annual salary by 15, that was the value of one talent. Then if you multiply it by two and five more to comprehend the amount of money that was involved in this story. In other words, the money that's involved here is not pocket change. Three servants are given three separate sums of money. One is given five, one is given two, and one is given one. The first thing that you need to hear in this parable is that the master is not concerned with being fair. He's not interested in treating them equally. He's not interested in giving all three of them the same sum of money. Being fair is not his priority. I don't know how my kids learned the phrase, "That's not fair." They picked it up somewhere. I don't know where they got it. It puzzles me. I asked my kids, "When did I ever promise to be fair to you?" I never promised to be fair to you. I tell my kids, when you were born, when you were a newborn, and I held you, Kendall, in my arms for the first time, I did not say to you, "Kendall, I'm going to be so fair to you." I never made that promise. I promised to love and to nurture, to lead my kids to follow Jesus, but I never promised anything about being fair. The truth is, we get preoccupied with fairness. We want everything to be equal. We want level ground. But the truth is, God isn't very concerned with fair. He's not. At the end of the book of John, the resurrected Jesus is having breakfast with the disciples. They're on the shore of Galilee. They're sitting around the campfire. Their bodies are tired after a long night of fishing. Their bellies are full of grilled fish. Their eyelids are falling. And Jesus takes Peter aside, and Jesus is giving Peter his orders. He's commissioning him. He's sending him, telling him about what his future is going to be and the direction that he's going to go with his life. And he tells him, "If you love me, then follow me. If you love me, then go and do my work." And this is one of the instances you can tell that Peter's feeling uncomfortable. This is probably one of the rare times when Peter deflects the attention off of himself onto someone else. Peter looks over at John off to the side, and Peter says, "Well, what about him? What about John? What are his marching orders? What are you going to do with him? You're telling me what I need to do and what my future is going to be and where I need to go, but what about him? What are John's orders?" And Jesus, in essence, says, "I'm going to give John his orders, but these are your orders." In other words, what Jesus is saying to Peter there is, "I'm not trying to be fair. I'm not interested in giving both of you the same future. These are your orders, Peter." And in the very same way, the master in this parable, he's not interested in being fair. The truth is, it doesn't matter what each servant has. What matters is what each servant does with what he has. Church, hear this. It doesn't matter what each servant has. What matters is what each servant does with what he or she has. Besides, it wasn't their wealth anyway. The master did not give them wealth in order to be their possession. Three times in this story, Jesus uses the word entrusted. This money is entrusted to the servants. He entrusts his wealth to them. They didn't earn it. They didn't do anything to get it. It's not theirs. The master puts the money in their hands. It's still his, but he puts it in their hands. He entrusts them with it, and then he goes away. Remember something about parables, folks. Parables are not tidy, simple, moral lessons. Parables don't go down so easy. Parables have sharp edges to them. Parables are meant to offend. Anytime Jesus tells a parable, he is meaning to offend. And if you don't hear the offense in a parable, then you're not hearing what Jesus is saying. One of the things about parables is they go against the grain of common wisdom. In Jesus' day, there was some common wisdom. The common wisdom is you play it safe. The honorable thing to do is to play it safe. If you happen to find yourself in a situation like these servants in this parable, then the honorable thing to do is bury that treasure. You hide it, you preserve it, you sit on it, you protect it, you leave nothing to chance, you opt for security, you play it safe. That was the honorable thing to do. Any other story that started like this one in Jesus' day would have ended with the one who buried the treasure getting patted on the back by the master, and the master saying, "Well done, faithful servant, you protected my money." People listening to Jesus tell this story, they would have thought the one who hides the treasure is the hero. The one who hides the treasure is the one who's doing the honorable thing. He's doing the right thing. He's keeping the master's treasure intact, and that's the one that needs to be rewarded. That was the common wisdom of Jesus' day. But since Jesus is the one telling the story, and since Jesus is interested in telling us what the kingdom of heaven is like, and since the kingdom of heaven goes against the grain of common wisdom, this parable has a different twist. This parable is not about common wisdom. It's about kingdom living. The two who did something with what was put into their hands were honored, celebrated. And the one who sat on it, the one who did nothing with what was put into his hands, was disgraced. And Jesus has some pretty strong language that he uses in this parable for the one who is disgraced. Jesus flipped the script on common wisdom. And this parable doesn't just tell us that the one servant acted wrongly. It also tells us why. Tells us why he acted wrongly. Because in verse 24, the servant says, "I knew you were a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and I hid your wealth in the ground. Here it is." The servant's actions stemmed from his view of the master. In other words, he acted in keeping with who he believed the master to be. He believed that the master was hard and stingy and miserly, and so that's exactly how the servant behaved. He behaved hard and stingy and miserly. Jesus is telling us something here about our relationship with God. He's telling us, however you perceive God to be, then that's how you live. However you perceive God to be, then that's how you behave in your life. If you believe that God is angry, then you live your life with anger. If you believe that God is freely permissive, a do what you want kind of God, then that's how you live your life. If you believe that God hates certain people, then that gives you a license to hate and you live with hatred. If you believe that God is stingy and miserly, then you live the very same way. If you believe that God is generous and open-handed and merciful, then you live generously and open-handed and mercifully. However you perceive God to be, chances are that is how you are living your life. And this particular servant in the story, he had a warped view of the master that led him to take the wrong action. And in this case, and in many cases, the wrong action is no action at all. Verse 25 gets to the heart of the matter. The servant himself says, "I did it out of fear. I was afraid, and so I buried it." He responded out of fear. Fear drove him, and fear drove him to do the wrong thing. That's what fear does. fear works on us. And if your life is motivated by fear, if fear has a hold on you, chances are you're making the wrong choices in your life, or you're not making any choices with your life. 1 John 4:18, John says, perfect love drives out fear. When fear drives you, the answer is to allow the perfect love of Christ to fill you and drive that fear out of you. Because when you're filled with the perfect love of Jesus, what is there to fear? When you're filled with his perfect love, what is there to fear? This parable, more than anything, it's a story about who the master is. We can get sidetracked by the servants and what each of the servants did and what the servants didn't do. But the truth is, the real point of the parable is to tell us more about who the master is than who the servants are. This parable is telling us about the nature and the character of God himself. For the two servants who did something with what they had, they did something with what was put into their hands. The master gave them praises and affirmation and blessing. He says, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful. I will entrust you with even more. Then the master says to them, come to me and share in my happiness. You get the sense that this master is filled with joy, and he's wanting to share, and he's inviting them to participate in his life. He's inviting them to participate in his joy. That's the kind of master this is. This is the kind of God we have. The master is not stingy. The master does not reward stinginess. Jesus is telling us here that stingy is not a value in the kingdom of heaven. Stingy is not one of the fruit of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is not love, joy, peace, patience, and stinginess. When Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus did not respond by saying, I tell you, the greatest commandment is be stingy toward God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and be stingy toward other people. That's not what he said. Stingy is not a value in the kingdom of heaven. God isn't stingy. He's open-handed. And if we belong to him, then we're called to live like him. In the kingdom of heaven, which runs counter to the wisdom of our world, in the kingdom of heaven, when you hold on to something, that is when you lose. And in the kingdom of heaven, when you let go and offer up what you have, that is when you win. And that's the reality of the kingdom of heaven. See, the way our world works, whatever it is that's in your hands, you just believe it's yours. You believe it's yours. You hold it. You clutch it. You keep it. You preserve it. You secure it. You protect it. You bury it. You believe it's yours to do that with. But the kingdom of heaven is about letting go of, offering up, releasing what you've been entrusted with, and being generous with what belongs to God in the first place. You are responsible for being generous with whatever it is that God has put into your hands. It's no accident, folks, that Jesus tells this parable right before he goes away. String of four parables all have the same pattern. Master going away, then returning, then coming back to judge people according to what they did do or didn't do. And Jesus tells these right before he himself goes away. He couldn't be more clear, couldn't be more blunt. You know, one day, my master will return. And I'm going to stand before him. And I don't know what he's going to ask me. He could ask me anything that he wants to ask me. But I suppose that a likely question that he could ask me could be, Darren, what did you do with what I put in your hands? You know, I think he's even more likely to ask that question than ask me, did you believe in me? Did you have me in your heart? Did you have good intentions? I think the question that he's more likely to ask me is, what did you do with what I put into your hands? So, church, I want to ask you this morning, first of all, what's in your hands? And second of all, what are you doing with it? Let me tell you about some things that God has put into your hands, some things that he's entrusted you with. First of all, he has put your body into your hands. You only have one, and you will only ever have one. What are you putting into it? What are you doing with it? How are you treating it? It's his body, and he's put it into your hands. Another thing that he's put into your hands is your time. Hours and days and weeks, months, years, decades. What are you doing with the time that he has put into your hands? Are you burying that time in the ground? Are you doing nothing with the time that he's given you? Are you piddling with that time? Or are you doing something with your time that matters in the scope of eternity? Obviously, according to the parable, one of the things that he's put into our hands is our money. He's put your money into your hands. Now, you can believe that your money is your possession, that God did not have anything to do with getting it into your hands, that you earned it and that it's yours and that you can do whatever you want with it. You can believe that if you want to, but you need to know that that's a lie. You need to know that that's a lie. However much you have is however much he has given you. Are you sitting on it? Or worse than that, are you just consuming all of it for yourself? Living like it's yours to do with whatever you want to do with it? Or are you living with regard to giving, open-handed, toward God and toward others? God has put your gifts and your abilities into your hand. Are you spending them for him? God has put relationships into your hand. He has entrusted you with relationships. Do your relationships with other people honor God? Do you treat other people with holy love? He's put those relationships into your hand. Of all the things that God has put into our hands, one of the most precious gifts that he's put into our hands are our children and our grandchildren. Do you know that they're his? They're his. And he has entrusted us with these precious lives. Are you taking seriously your responsibility to lead them to follow Jesus, to nurture them, to disciple them toward maturity in Jesus Christ? The last thing I'm going to say that God has put into your hands is your influence. God has put your influence into your hands. You have the power to influence other people in your life. You can use that influence to harm or to criticize, to tear down, to bully. You can use that power to your own advantage. or you can use that power to encourage, to love, to build up, and to create. One day, every one of us is going to stand before him, and a likely question that he's going to ask each of us is, what did you do with what I put into your hands? In his wild book that everyone should read, Love Does, Bob Goff tells a story about his Jeep. His Jeep was fire engine red, and he says it was jacked up so high you could pull your groin getting into it. Had a roll bar with a fire extinguisher strapped to it. It was a manly machine. He says, if I could have installed seats made of beef jerky, I would have. One day, driving home from church, a car darted out from a side street and crashed into the side of his Jeep. The Jeep started to barrel roll and threw Bob from the Jeep. Bob went flying, he says, like someone was playing cornhole with my body. Bob ended up being okay. He got up, dusted himself off. He approached the other vehicle, and there he met a shaken little old lady named Lynn. He began a relationship with Lynn, and it became an incredible opportunity for Bob to extend grace into Lynn's life. Even though the Jeep was totaled, Bob wanted it back. So he bought it back from the insurance company. He slapped a new coat of red paint on it. He says that the Jeep had some issues after that. The steering wheel pulled hard to the left. He said all he needed to do when he was approaching his driveway was to slam on the brakes and the thing would make the hard turn left into his driveway. His Jeep left puddles of oil wherever he parked it. He says it had tons of other glitches, little things that only an owner would notice. And you know what? Bob ended up loving that Jeep even more than he did before the accident. He says now it was way cooler. It was tougher. It was even more manly than it was before. Bob says, now the Jeep has a story. Before, it just looked like it had a story, but now it actually has a story. And Bob said that the story made it leak. These are Bob's words. I know it sounds goofy, but I want to be like that Jeep. I want to leak from having been hit by Jesus, from having something crazy happen to me, something that flipped my life upside down. Bob says, I've met people like that, people who leak Jesus. Whenever you're around them, Jesus keeps coming up with words and with actions. When your life actually collides with Jesus, you talk about him differently. You live differently. You start steering funny. You start leaking where you stand. And it's because you got thrown from your life into a terrific collision. Folks, here's what I know. My life has collided with Jesus. He's flipped me upside down. And I want my life to be lived like someone who has collided with Jesus. I want to leak. I want to steer funny. I want to be different. I don't want to live like the world. I don't want to live for me. I don't want to live in fear. I don't want to live idle. I don't want to live stingy and hoarding and clutching. I want to live differently. I want to live open-handed. I want to live giving generously. I want to live for Jesus. I want to leak for him. I want to take everything that he's put into my hands and offer it up for his glory. Church, would you stand with me? Two questions this morning. What's in your hands? And what are you doing with it? I'm going to pray in a minute, and I'm just going to trust that the Spirit's talking. Maybe there's something in particular. Maybe it is your money or your time or your relationships or your influence. Maybe it's your gifts or your abilities, or maybe it's your kids or your grandkids. Maybe the Holy Spirit is putting his finger today on that one thing that he's put into your hands, he's entrusted you with, and you've buried it. You're acting like it's yours. You're doing nothing with it. You're playing it safe. Maybe he's talking to you about everything that he's put into your hands. Maybe it's all of the above. And maybe he's saying to you this morning, you have collided with me. I've wrecked your life. I've flipped you upside down. Live like somebody who's collided with me. Live different. Leak from me. These parables that Jesus tell us, they're about the nature of the kingdom of heaven and how the kingdom of heaven is radically different from the world that we live in. And as people who live in this world, we can so often just buy into the values of the world. The values of the world that say, it's all yours. If it's in your hands, it's yours. You do what you want with it. Live like it's yours. Protect it. Bury it. Do whatever you want. You earned it. It's yours. And church, you need to hear today that that's a lie. That's a lie. In the kingdom of heaven, when you hold on to what's in your hands, you lose. And when you offer up what he's put into your hands, that's when you win. That's when the master says, come and share in my life. Come and share in my joy. Come and share in my happiness. That's the life that he has for us. And that's who our God is. I'm going to pray, and I just want to ask you today, would you just be open to him and obedient to whatever he's asking you to do? The altar's open as I pray.